Okay. I think we're okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to introduce, of course, the wonderful Rabbi Breitowitz. You're lucky, and I'm lucky, and all of us. Rivka isn't here this evening due to the fact that she's suffering from exhaustion. But by gosh, I know that she'll be in tomorrow morning. She asked me to ask you, please keep your questions until after Rabbi Breitowitz is through with the entire lecture.
Okay.
Enjoy
the evening. Don't tell her grandmother she's not feeling well.
Exhaustion
from doing
mitzvahs.
Exactly. Yeah, well, this is certainly a well-deserved rest. Rivka does so much for all of the people here and the people who are not here, and we do owe her a great debt of gratitude. I again want to talk, last 2 weeks we've been talking about reproductive technologies and the different ways that halacha allows one to have children, and what do you do with surplus eggs, in vitro surrogacy. And now I'm going to talk about something that typically is an end of life question, and that is the issue of organ donation. All of you probably know, there is an organization that actively promotes organ donation within the Frum community. That is called the Halachic Organ Donor Society, HODS. They have a very, very good website. And you see their advertisements in all sorts of magazines, although not Mishpacha or Modia, but in some of the Jewish Action or the like, where they show how many different rabbis, you know, have signed, you know, various organ donor consent cards. Although it's a little misleading because they sign it with certain conditions that aren't always articulated in the advertisement. And the founder of this organization was a fellow, Rabbi Berman, who was a friend of the Flato family. Remember, I think it's the 20th anniversary of the tragic death by terrorism of a young woman. Then she was 20 years old, Alyssa Flato, who was here for a year in Eretz Israel, and she was killed in a terrorist attack. And her parents, based on a psak of Rav Moshe Tendler, who's going to be a big player in this area, donated her vital organs to various people. I think three or four people were able to live because of that donation. And as a result, the parents became quite active in promoting this as a cause. And we'll see, though, that it is a big, big controversy in halacha. But I will say, to the credit of Halachic Organ Donor Society, although it is absolutely advocating a specific position, there is no question that they're pushing for this. But in terms of the articles they present on the website, they present many, many articles on the halachos of organ donation. They do try to be balanced. They do present the articles from the other side. I myself have two or three articles on the website that they took from different places. And really, if you're interested in to be ma'ayin in the halachos, at least in a less technical way and in the English language, it's a very good place to look. It's hods.org. But as they say, the person does have an agenda. L'shem Shemayim, but he does have an agenda, but he does try to be, evenly balanced in terms of bringing, I do want to summarize the basic halachic debate. And what's interesting is that B'Sof Yamav, Rav Ovadia did actually take a very lenient position, although, I don't think we have, a clear written tshuva from him. We have like a short letter, which was towards the end of his life, in which he actually did endorse the concept of organ donation, and I'll discuss what the issue is. First of all, when we discuss organ donation, there are three different categories you have to consider, and they are three totally different areas of halacha that one has nothing to do with the other. The first is a totally different sugya about live organ donation. There are certain organs a person can give while they're still alive, and they can continue to be alive, and the most common would be kidney donations, right? HaKadosh Baruch Hu made us with two kidneys. And although optimally, obviously, there's a reason why we have two kidneys, but a person can live with one kidney. And as a result, it is yitachen that I can give a kidney to someone who would be able to live and not be on dialysis. A live organ donation. Now, of course, most organs cannot be donated live. You can't give your heart as a live donor. You can give your liver, a part of your liver. Interestingly enough, the liver can regenerate itself with as little as 20% of its tissue, so it is possible to be a live liver donor. It is also possible to give part of a lung. A lung can be donated as well. For various reasons, although you would think a parent would be most likely to want to give part of a liver to a child, or vice versa, transplant centers very much try not to take donations from parents to children or children to parents, simply because parents or children might not objectively be able to assess the risk. Sometimes it might be overly dangerous for them. They're too emotionally involved to make a decision, but it can be done, and it has been done. So let's first talk about this. This is not the main controversy.
Are there any issues involving blood donation?
I'll get to it. I would include that. In other words, in addition to kidney and liver and lung, you have both blood donation and marrow donation. And what we'll talk, I'll talk about that together in this topic one. So topic one is, what are the halachas about giving things while you are alive? So the emesis, the poskim have said that this is connected to a big controversy, and that is, we know that generally a person is not allowed to put themselves in a makom sakana. You're not supposed to endanger yourself unnecessarily. Now, this is a loaded question, what is called an unnecessary danger. You know, there are people who say that living in Israel is a sakana, although the truth of the matter is, you know, and I know that right now it's a very, very stressful time, and of course we've suffered actual tragedies, great, great tragedies on the ground. But you know, you do have to take the long picture here. I mean, even from a pure statistical standpoint, pure statistics, without even talking about the Kedushas HaAretz and the spirituality of Eretz Yisrael and the privilege of Eretz Yisrael, the truth of the matter is, statistically, it is safer to live here. Not only here, even in the Shtachim, it is safer to live in this, quite amazing, to live in the Shtachim than it is to live in Brooklyn or New York City, other Washington DC or Atlanta. So it's pretty amazing, although obviously because we're a small country, and, and the world is focused on us, and of course, because everyone is connected to everyone, every tragedy really rips our hearts, and we feel it very, very deeply. But Lamaisa, to say that Eretz Yisrael is more dangerous than other places is honestly not true, just from a purely statistical basis. But be it as, and of course, when we talk about don't put yourself in sakana, well, what does that mean? Can I drive? Can I take a bus? Can I cross the street in Yerushalayim? You know, everything you do is an element of sakana. And even if you're going to say, okay, I'll stay in bed and not move. Well, I remember in Washington, D.C. at least, there was an 8-year-old boy who was just killed in bed because there was a drug war outside of his house, and you know, a bullet just went through the wall of the apartment building, you know, and he died in bed. So obviously I'm going to fudge this a little bit and say that the halacha does not prohibit doing anything that causes a risk of danger, but what is called unreasonable excessive dangers. Okay, I'm going to leave it a little undefined. But the question is this. So there is a general rule, asur lahachnis atzmo besakana. But the question is, am I allowed to put myself in possible danger in order to save somebody who is in certain danger? So someone, now the way the poskim have characterized it, and you can actually argue with this medically, they have said that when a person donates a kidney, although he certainly can live with one kidney, but he is increasing the risks to his health because there's a strain on the kidney and the like, and he's putting himself in at least possible sakana. On the other hand, the person he's helping is already in a matzav that he's dangerously ill. So, are you allowed to put yourself in what is called safek sakana in order to matzil somebody who is in vadai sakana? The Talmud Yerushalmi actually says there's an obligation to do so. The Bavli does not mention such a principle, and most Meforshim understand that the Bavli does not agree with the Yerushalmi. But the tshuva of the Radvaz was a great posek around the time of the Beis Yosef, says that you are not obligated to put yourself in safek sakana to save somebody in vadei sakana, but if you do so, you are permitted to do so, and it is called a mitzvah, and it is called a zechus. So the bottom line, therefore, would be, I'll get to blood in a moment, the bottom line would be, nobody is chayev to be a kidney donor. You are not obligated to be a kidney donor. You are not, because that is putting yourself in a safek sakana. But if your health and your overall condition permits it. It is a zechus, it is a merit, it is a great thing, and one will get reward, but one cannot be critical, meaning I cannot criticize somebody who didn't make that donation, because we paskin, a person is not obligated to put themselves in safek sakana in order to be matzil, even somebody from avadei sakana, even if that person is Jewish or a relative or the like. Now, because of this, there was an interesting psak about around 20 years ago. There was a teenager here in Israel who needed a kidney transplant, and you need a genetically compatible donor because otherwise the body rejects it. And the only compatible donor was a younger sibling who was like 11 years old. And the younger sibling wanted to give an organ, and the parents wanted him to give. But the psak halacha was, since there's no obligation to give an organ, it is based on consent. You have to consent. So a katan, below bar mitzvah, does not have the age of consent, and therefore we cannot take an organ from a katan, and even though the parents consented, but the right of a parent to consent, this is even halacha, the right of a parent to consent to medical treatment for a child is only if it's for the benefit of the child, but the parents cannot consent to a procedure done to one child that will only be for the benefit of the other child. And by the way, if this sounds harsh, let me point out that in secular legal systems, it is virtually the identical law, and let me point out as well that the age of majority is much higher, meaning to say, it's 18 years old, as opposed to halacha, the child would have the status of an adult at either 12 or 13. So as a result, I believe it was a tragic result. I think the older sibling died, and it's very, very difficult. And in truth, one could argue with the psak, because one could say that even if the psak's yesodos are 100% true, but one could argue that to save an older brother is not only a benefit for the older brother, it is a benefit for the younger brother in two ways. Number one, it gives him the companionship and love of an older brother. And number two, it removes the guilt feelings. I mean, because one could imagine that if the younger brother realizes that he might have saved his brother's life but was not able to do so, although he has no reason to feel guilty because he was willing to do it, but one kind of tortures oneself over and over again. So one could argue with that particular psak, but the yesod makes sense, and that is, since there is no chiyuv to donate, it is a reshus is based on haskama, on consent. A katan is not able to give that consent. Now, let me give you a parallel case. You may have heard of this case. I think they wrote a book on it, and I think there's even a lawsuit now, unfortunately. And I think I may have mentioned it about the Ayala family, and this involves bone marrow donation, and it was a similar type of problem where an adolescent girl needed bone marrow for leukemia. Now, bone marrow has a well-established registry. There are registries of compatible bone marrow donors. But once again, there was no compatible donor. Her parents were not compatible. So mom and dad thought to do something to conceive a child. And maybe the new baby will be a compatible donor. This was a pretty amazing story because dad had a vasectomy, which had to be surgically reversed. And that's only like a 40% chance. Mom was taking chemotherapy for breast cancer, and she could not get pregnant until she went into remission and the drugs were flushed out of her system. She was also over 40, in which case, you know, the fertility rate, you know, goes down. And finally, who says if neither parent are genetically compatible, who says the sibling is going to be genetically compatible? Now, if you combined it with cloning, perhaps you could guarantee that aspect, but this is pre-cloning and the like. So be it as it may, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was good to them. Dad's vasectomy was reversed, mom went into remission, she was able to get pregnant, and miraculously, little baby Marissa was a compatible bone marrow donor, and by a few days after birth, they were able to take bone marrow, and I think more than 10 years later, both sisters are doing okay. Now, I do understand, somebody just told me, I hate a bad end to such a great story, that, huh? Yes, baby Marissa. That somebody told me baby Marissa is suing her parents for an unwanted assault. I'm not sure exactly, you know, that it was done.
It's a U.S. case, actually.
It's a U.S. case, and the like. So everything in the United States turns into a lawsuit. But at the time, what was interesting is that all of the media, the New York Times, were talking about the ethics of conceiving a child to be a bone marrow donor. Now, it's a funny thing what becomes an ethical problem. If somehow they would just abort the kid, abortion is mucho legamri, Roe versus Wade, you know, right of privacy, God forbid you can answer abortion in the United States. And yet, if instead of abortion they give birth to a child that they raise and they love, who happens to also be used for bone marrow, that is the severe ethical problem. Which wouldn't have happened if they just aborted her and the like. But putting that aside, let's just focus on this. If this would have been a halakhic case, so here's the question. If we cannot take a kidney from an 11-year-old who wants to give, then how would we be allowed to take bone marrow from a 3-day-old baby who certainly was not capable of consent? And the short answer is this. That the only reason why you need consent for an organ donation is because donation of an organ like a kidney puts you in a possible state of danger to your life, and since you're not obligated to put yourself in skana, you have to agree. By contrast, the removal of bone marrow, although indeed there is some pain, and I'm not going to say there's no danger at all, because putting anyone under general anesthesia is potentially dangerous, and certainly a newborn baby, you have to, you know, if the dose is a tiny bit too high, you know, that's it. But the risk is Baruch Hashem, very, very, very low. And as a result, and of course bone marrow itself replenishes. So as a result, one could say, even if there's no obligation to give an organ, and therefore you need consent, that would be less true for bone marrow. And coming to transfusions, therefore, it would appear in the case of transfusions, where the blood generally regenerates, it would seem logically that there ought to be a chiyuv to give blood if you're able to give blood, and you have the right type for what is needed in a particular situation. Now, I have to say that even here, poskim have been reluctant. They have not imposed an absolute chiyuv, but they have talked about it as a great mitzvah. The one exception is the Tzitz Eliezer. And it's interesting, the Tzitz Eliezer was a great posek, and the Tzitz Eliezer was a very lenient posek. But strangely enough, when it comes to blood transfusions, he takes an extraordinarily machmir view, in which he says a Jew is not allowed to give blood, because since blood is your nefesh, so every time you give blood, it's ki'ilu, you're killing part of yourself. Again, the truth of the matter is, biologically, that's hard to really understand, because you're obviously not killing yourself, and it regenerates. If anything, Rav Voldenberg's position is identical to the Witnesses, the Christian group, the J Witnesses, who indeed they don't give blood, they don't accept blood for precisely that reason. And most poskim have certainly endorsed blood donation, because it doesn't involve any of the issues of putting yourself in sakana. It does not put yourself in sakana at all. At most, you'll be tired for a while, and whatever it is, and there is no sakana.
There are
okay.
Legal cases compelling witnesses to take blood in the case of a child where they, for religious reasons, they refuse to subject.
Right. That's right. That's the general constitutional law in the United States. That one's religious beliefs cannot deprive children of medical treatment. The state will move in and either terminate the parental rights or whatever it is, order the parents to provide that medical treatment. The same thing is true for Christian Scientists who don't give medical treatment to their children. And many of them will sometimes go to jail for child abuse. They're not abusive per se, but because they don't give medical treatment, they could be convicted of abuse, neglect, and they could be sent to jail, even. Okay, so that's the issue of live donation. Now, that's category one. Category one, live donation, and again, the issue is there is no obligation, but it is a meritorious act, and one gets reward for it. And the only issue is you have to be sure there is consent. Now, let's take the other extremity, which I will call cadaveric donation. And that is the removal of organ or tissue from a body that's clearly dead, ready to go to the cemetery, meaning there was no heartbeat, totally dead. Now here, you have to understand the following. As you'll see as I go on, vital organs like the heart and the liver cannot really be taken from a cadaver because they deteriorate very, very quickly. So there's not a lot you can take from a body that's already stone cold and ready for burial, but there are a few things you can take. You can take corneas for a while, which can help in blindness. Skin can survive for a while for burn victims and the like. A heart and liver does not come up. That'll be a middle category I'll get to, an intermediate status of death. So here, if you ask the average Orthodox Jew why halacha would be against organ donation, you'll commonly hear something like, well, we're not allowed to mutilate corpses. That's called nivul hames. We have to bury the body, kavura, and that's why we don't have mausoleums or cremation, God forbid. And we also have a belief in tchiyas hamesim, resurrection of the dead, so we can't be pulling out body parts. Now, all of that might be true, but that absolutely is not the reason for any problem, because the following. Yes, is there an issur to dissect, cut up corpses? Absolutely. Is there an obligation to try to bury an entire body? Absolutely. But those are not one of the big three, like avodah zarah, gilui reis v'chasdanim, and it's a dover pashut, that whatever aveira is involved in desecrating a corpse is going to be set aside if there's pikuach nefesh, at least for a Jew. I'll talk about for a non-Jew in a moment. And to say, but if I take away somebody's organ, you know, there's not going to be tchias hamesim. Well, obviously, you know, that can't be true because tchias hamesim is a miraculous process. I mean, what about people who were burnt, cremated in the Holocaust? And anyway, bodies disintegrate. And by the time tchias hamesim comes, Hashem is going to have to make a new body anyway. So that wouldn't be the concern. Meaning, cadaveric organ donation is going to be mutter and even a mitzvah if, now this is a big if it is a pikuach nefesh situation. Now, that does raise some questions. If it is a pikuach nefesh situation. Well, question number one is, well, let's take something like a corneal transplant that can avert blindness. Is that considered to be a pikuach nefesh situation? Blindness. Well, that's right. So the question is that called a life-threatening situation? So here we have a tshuva, a long tshuva from Rav Unterman, who was a Rav Harashi of Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Unterman said, both in terms of the chazal that say, Iver Choshev Kameis, a blind person, a Doma Lameis, a blind person is comparable to a dead person. And then, just as a matter of common sense, a person who's blind may face all sorts of, you know, dangers crossing the streets or whatever it is. It's enough to classify it as pikuach nefesh. By the way, I have not been there, but some of my students have this Museum of the Blind in Cologne, I think it is. They tell me it's quite an amazing experience. So the blind and deaf, they're two separate experiences you can go through, what it's like to be blind, what it's like to be deaf. By the way, Helen Keller, who was both, once remarked that she thought deafness was even worse than blindness in terms of isolation, but Hashem should help us from both of those things. Same thing with skin grafts. Obviously, skin grafts can be used for burn victims and the like. On the other hand, you don't always know if your skin graft could be used for a nose job or some cosmetic surgery. It wouldn't be. So issue number one is that cadaveric organ donations are certainly going to be allowed makom pikuach nefesh, but is it pikuach nefesh? There's a famous tshuva from the native Yehuda that just leaving your body to science is not going to be allowed, because although obviously autopsies and scientific dissections give rise to knowledge that in the long run may save a life, the heter of pikuach nefesh requires at least the possibility, not the certainty, even a small possibility, that somebody directly now will benefit and be saved. You don't do long-term science. Otherwise, the Rebbe Huda says, the whole Torah could be butl, meaning every doctor this is not his example, but every doctor could say, you know, I will drive to my medical school lecture on Shabbos because maybe I will hear something that 20 years from now will allow me to save somebody. You know, you can't. Pikuach nefesh cannot work that way because then kol ha-Torah kulo zbatel. So that's one important distinction, that pikuach nefesh requires a patient who will might benefit, and not just generalized knowledge of leaving your body to science. Second issue is, does pikuach nefesh apply to non-Jews? Now, this is one of the halachas that Rav Soloveitchik once said, and both the Rav Yeshiva Soloveitchik and the Sri Deyesh, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who you might say were great gedolim, who were also very well secularly educated and the like, that they felt that morally they had a lot of difficulties with this halacha. It was a gezeiras hakasev they couldn't quite understand. And that is the statement in the Mishnah in Yuma that says that if a building collapses on a person, and it's Shabbos or Yom Kippur, and we have to do malacha to possibly save their lives, so the Mishnah says if you're not sure if it's a Jew or a Goy, you of course desecrate the Shabbos because maybe it's a Jew. But if you know it's a Goy, the halacha is you're not allowed to violate Shabbos to save the life of a Goy. Now this is beferish in the Gemara. Now the truth of the matter is, practically speaking, the poskim have worked out all sorts of ways that you do save a Goy. So if it's Shabbos, you know, God, in fact, this was once reported, but the whole story was false. It was reported that in a religious neighborhood, a non-Jew or an Arab, you know, got a heart attack, and people just walked by and refused to call, you know, the ambulance or the like. It turned out this was totally false. This was mamish libel, a slander on religious Jews. But it's also true that if you simply read the Shulchan Aruch, that would be the halacha. But all the poskim give us all sorts of ways out that lemaisa you do it. One argument is Eva. Eva is hatred. If you don't save the non-Jew, you're going to incite hatred and the like, and ultimately, therefore, the Jewish people are going to be endangered. Again, one can certainly imagine the scenario in Israel very, very easily, as we see. If the Arab is margish, you know, as they say, what was it? I don't want to get into too many political things. This Arab kid, or this American Arab kid, who was a cousin, I think, of the victim. So I think he got slapped or something. So Obama issued a statement of profound concern over this spoiled American kid who may have got slapped because he was throwing a rock at a policeman. I don't recall the term profound concern used when Naftali Frankel, Hashem Yinkum Dam, who happens to be an American citizen, was murdered, which I think is a lot worse than getting a slap after you throw a rock at a policeman. But okay, be it as it may, one could certainly imagine the Eva scenario in which we gotta be Machal Shabbos for the Goy, or the Jewish population will be endangered. And in addition, the poskim say if you do the malacha with a shinoi, which is very easy, just do it in less than the normal way, other than the normal way, that makes it an issur d'rabbanan, and an issur d'rabbanan you can do for a Goy. So when push comes to shove, halacha does allow you to save a Goy. But somebody asked Rav Soloveitchik, are you morally comfortable with those answers? Because you're still saying the guy's life is not worth it, but we'll figure out some loophole. So Rav Soloveitchik didn't want to talk about it. He says, I have some problems with understanding it. So again, I'm not going to defend it other than to note that this is the halacha. But memela, this turns out a lot with organ donation, because remember, the actual removal of an organ is prohibited. It involves desecration of the corpse. It involves a beetle of the mitzvah of kavura. And if the heter is only pikuach nefesh, then the question becomes, there is no heter of pikuach nefesh for non-Jews. And you can't even use the Eva argument, and I'll tell you why. The Eva argument, that if I don't save the guy, I'm going to endanger the Jews, that makes sense if a guy gets a heart attack and I do nothing. But if I don't give organs because it's going to go to a non-Jew, that's not going to cause Eva, because the truth of the matter is, organ donation in the general population is very low. So it's hard to say nobody's going to turn against the Jews. Hey, why didn't you give your organs? Well, why didn't you give your organs? I mean, you can say the same thing. So Eva's very shvach heter. So there are two issues to keep in mind. One is Pikuach nefesh does not encompass general experimentation, leaving your body to science, a dissection, anatomy. Two, pikuach nefesh might not embrace a donation to non-Jews. Now, three, let me just mention, just to be intellectually honest, there is a view of the Binyan Siyan. The Binyan Siyan, known in the yeshiva world more for, as the Orech Lanier. The Orech Lanier is the name of his Sefer on Gemara, and Binyan Siyan are his Shelos Tshuvos, was a very great German Rav in the mid-19th century, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, and he's often known as the Rebbe of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. But he also had a university degree, and he was considered to be, in fact, some describe him as the last traditional Goy. The first was already breaking with tradition in some ways. The last traditional Goy, meat and potatoes Goy in Germany, was Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. And he issued a lot of psukim, just as an aside. One of his most famous psukim is still used today. That is, he was the one that said, remember, he lived during the beginning of the Reform movement. And he was the one that said that the average Reform Jew who touches wine that's not mavushal does not prohibit the wine to be drunk, because although a public Shabbos desecrator is treated like a guy who forbids the wine, but he considered the children born into the Reform movement as tinok shenishba, as babies who were captured, who never were exposed to Judaism. And although in Eretz Yisrael, the poskim tend to be strict, to be sure, but in America, this is a heter that is used all the time for non-mavushal wine. And I know in a yeshiva like Or Sameach, where many of our students are there to learn, but some of them are not technically Shomer Shabbos, although we try to have mavushal wine, we do try to, in order to avoid the problem, but Lamaisa, in Or Sameach, for example, we are mako on this. But that's not our subject. The tshuva that he did write is the following. He said a fascinating thing. He actually said, removal of organs is prohibited from a dead body, even if it's b'makom b'kuach nefesh. And listen to the reason that he gave. The reason that he gave is, since when a person is dead, they are no longer obligated to keep mitzvahs, it's not possible to take from the dead body because of the mitzvah of keeping another Jew alive. So, in a sense, his kavod, in other words, I have to do what I can to keep people alive. Pikuach nefesh. But the dead body doesn't have to do it. So therefore, I'm not allowed to do to the dead body a desecration to save a life. But that is a das yochid. That is a das yochid. That's an opinion of one. And the overwhelming majority of poskim absolutely do permit the removal of cadaveric organs in order to save a Jewish life. A Jewish life. And they consider this, and they consider blindness as well, to be considered a life-saving operation. Okay, so I covered two categories, and this is not yet the main controversy. I covered live organ donation, and I covered cadaveric organ donation. But the biggest halachic category is also the largest situation of organ donation, and that is the donation of vital organs, such as the heart, of course, the liver. Now here, let me explain why this is very complicated. And that is, you know, heart transplants, some of you may remember, I guess almost everybody here may remember the first heart transplant was in 1967. That was, huh? No, it was Christian Barnard. Christian Barnard. No, it was not that early. Maybe 66 or 67. Dr. Christian Barnard in Cape Town, South Africa. Definitely was a human heart. Yeah. No, there were attempts at artificial hearts beforehand, but they didn't work. But the first human heart taken from a donor, and in those days, as Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote, we're really killing two people for the price of one, because basically the donor died right away, and the recipient died right away, because it was such an experimental procedure.
18 days.
Huh? 18 days. Yeah, but he would have lived long. He would have lived longer. In other words, the guy is sick. He would have died in 20 days. In other words, it actually shortened his life by a little bit.
Even 10 minutes or 5 minutes is still taking the life.
That's right. So the point Rav Moshe made was the earlier transplant procedures, even in terms of the recipients, he lived less than he would have lived. But now, Baruch Hashem, transplant surgery is a well-developed medical specialty, and people with heart transplants can live 5, even 10 years, and that could be very significant in terms of a quality of life, and could be a good quality of life as well. But here is the problem. The problem basically is that the heart muscle, when it's deprived of oxygen, I'm going to use heart as my example, the heart muscle deteriorates very, very rapidly, meaning to say 6 minutes, certainly less than a half an hour after regular death, and I'll discuss what regular death is, the heart is not suitable for transplantation. So this created a real problem. How do you do a heart transplant if you have to wait? I mean, nobody's going to say, I could kill a person to give somebody a heart. On the other hand, if I wait until he's dead, the heart's not going to be suitable for transplantation. So because of this, what happened in the, I'm talking legally now, I'll talk about it halakhically in a moment. What happened, there was a major revolution in medical ethics in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s, in which the very term death was redefined. Now this already is a very curious exercise. You redefine death to permit you to do something that you wouldn't be allowed to do had you not redefined it. It's like, in other words, like this. If, under the classical definition of death, the removal of a heart from somebody is murder. I'll explain why. So we redefine death so it's not murder. That's already curious. In fact, Dr. James Watson, the co-discoverer of the DNA molecule, once said, hey, this is an easy way to deal with the problem of defective newborns, right? You have children, God forbid, who are born with very severe defects. Now, people who do abortion, but once the kid is born, you can't do anything. So what if the parents are caught unawares and have a severely defective newborn? So he suggested, why don't we define life as starting not on birth, but let's define life as starting 72 hours after birth. So as a result, what you do within the first 72 hours is not infanticide, but it's simply late-term abortion. In other words, this highlights an idea that sometimes people use language and they use definitions to permit the unethical. In fact, the truth of the matter is, even... But even that refers, you're not allowed to kill an aphobiodyne, first of all, and that refers only to a premature baby that had no ability to reach that life. You know, even the Holocaust occurs in that scenario. In other words, if you look at it, I mean, if you're a civilized German, you're a cultured person, and okay, a lot of the Nazis were just barbarians, but there were certainly Germans who, if you met them before the war, you know, they would seem like genteel, polite people, PhDs. So essentially, the way they psychologically get themselves into this is convincing themselves, and this is the vocabulary, Jews were vermin, Jews were subhuman, Jews were devils. This is the whole process of demonization, which allows you to do things that no normal person could ever do. And this goes on, even though I'm not saying people are Nazis here, but this goes on in medical ethics all the time, where you redefine terms to permit things that would otherwise be unthinkable. This is what happened with death. Let me explain. The classic, if you would have looked, again, I'm speaking legally now, and then I'm going to move into halacha and explain the problem. If you were to look at a law dictionary or a court case, let us say 50 years ago, and you would look, when is a person dead? So you would see the following idea. A person is dead when there is irreversible cessation of vital signs, including circulation of blood and breathing. Meaning, there are two signs that declare a person dead, and both of those signs have to be irreversible. No heartbeat or pulse, meaning there is no circulation of blood, and number two, there is no breathing. That is when something is, and it's irreversible. That is when someone is called a cadaver, ready for the funeral, ready for a beis hakvoros. If you applied that definition to a heart transplant, it would be impossible to ever remove a heart because the person, the heart would be not suitable. So what happened was a new definition of death was formulated based on the brain. And this goes by different names. It is called brain death. It is called cerebral death. It might be called brain stem death. It might be called whole brain death. All of this is the same. Now here, I have to make an extremely important point. Again, many of you may know this, but forgive me for reiterating it. Brainstem death, brain death, whole brain death, cerebral death, is not the same as being in a coma. In a coma, which is often called a persistent vegetative state, even though the person lacks consciousness, the brain stem of the person is still controlling the systems of the body. If you take if you remember a young woman, Terry Schiavo, a number of years ago. Terry Schiavo was in a coma for many years, for 15 years, but she was not on a respirator. She was breathing on her own. She was digesting nutrition on her own. She had body temperature. Terry Schiavo is not brain dead. Now, colloquially, people might say, call it brain death, but absolutely not. That's a persistent vegetative state. And legally and halakhically, a person in that condition is alive. And if you were to take an organ from Terry Schiavo, there is no machlokas whatsoever that that would be murder. And indeed, legally, it would have been murder. I mean, the most the court said is, you can withhold nutrition, and that's a whole other question that we can discuss. But if somebody were to shoot Terry Schiavo, they would be tried for murder. That's not what brain death is, okay? Be sure you understand that. Brain death is one step, unfortunately, beyond that. Brain death is a neurological diagnosis that the brain stem itself is destroyed. As a result, there is no capacity of breathing, because respiration is controlled by the brain stem. There is no digestion. Problem is body temperature. There is. That's actually a little bit of a problem that shows it's not a complete diagnosis. But here is the point. The heart has its own pacemaker. The heart is not directly controlled by the brain. Now, if there's no oxygen coming in, the heart muscle dies. But if you pump in oxygen, even mechanically, through a ventilator, the heart will continue to beat and circulate blood on its own. It's very important. The heart is not totally controlled by the brain. Respiration is controlled by the brain. The heartbeat is not. It has its own neurological center. As a result, this is how we do heart transplants. Basically, there is a neurological diagnosis of brain death, but the heart muscle doesn't atrophy, because we can supply oxygen through a respirator. Now, this doesn't last forever. In other words, a person could be in a coma for many years. A person cannot be in a brain death situation that long. Eventually, I think the maximum amount of time that somebody survived on a respirator once there was a clinical diagnosis of brain death was 6 months. There is no recorded instance, unless it was a mistaken diagnosis, which is a possibility. There is no recorded instance. Somehow, even though the heart has its own pacemaker, but Hashem made it in such a way that that's only a temporary state, meaning if there's no brain connection. Now, to do a clinical, so do you understand this? In other words, this is very important. The whole ability to do a heart transplant is because brain death replaced the older definition of death as the legal definition of death, and therefore the heart muscle is still pumping blood, oxygenated blood, and we cut into it, remove the heart, we have a good heart, and we can save somebody. This is called the brain death definition. It is the definition of death in all 50 states in the United States. It is in most European countries. State of Israel goes back and forth here, but basically the times when Israel permitted organ donation was in reliance on brain death, because the Rabbanut HaRashit back in the 1980s, did endorse the idea of brain death, permitting Hadassah Hospital to do heart transplants. But you have to understand, the whole edifice of heart transplantation is predicated on the acceptance of brain death as the definition of death, because without that definition, you'd have to wait until cardiac death, meaning there is no heartbeat, and at that point, heart muscle would atrophy in a very, very short time and not be suitable for transplantation. So as a result, the primary halachic issue about organ donation is not about autopsies or cutting into corpses or techiyas hamesim. All of that wouldn't be a problem if it's pikuach nefesh. The problem is murder, because The one thing you're not allowed to do for pikuach nefesh is you're not allowed to murder one person to save another person. Now here is the issue. This is why this is such an important debate. If halacha accepts brain death as death, then when I remove a heart from a brain dead person, all I'm doing is removing something from a cadaver to save another person. So as I indicated, except for the binyan sion, pikuach nefesh would say, you're allowed to do that. Not only are you allowed to do that, but it would be a mitzvah to do that. So organ donation can be the biggest mitzvah. But if you don't accept brain death as a halachic definition of death, then it's a very serious thing. Removal of the organ is murdering a person in order to save another person. And the one thing halacha says you cannot do is, you cannot kill A to save B. Now, if A is a rodef, if A is a terrorist, if A is somebody threatening me, then of course, either I or somebody else can kill him. That's habal ha-hagacha, somebody who's coming to kill you, hashkein v'haraglo, you go and kill them first. We're not talking about the din of rodef, but to kill that unconscious patient on the operating table, or the unconscious donor, in order to save somebody else, you can't kill A to save B. So, organ donation is a very serious question. It either becomes the greatest mitzvah you can do, or it becomes the absolute biggest avera you can do, and that is to murder somebody to save somebody else. And you can't even make a cheshvan, well, wait a second here, this guy is brain dead and he's going to die for sure in less than 6 months, no question about it, and this other person might be able to live, you know, for 10 years, and maybe he's a Talmud Chacham or a Gadol or a scientist or a great person with a big family. Well, it makes no difference, because that's what the Gemara says. We are not allowed to make comparisons as to whose life is more worthwhile. Even if this person is unconscious and comatose and will never come out of his coma and is going to die just 10 minutes from now, I am not allowed to kill him to save somebody who might live 30 years. Because as Chazal say, who knows whose blood is redder? Now again, you'll say, well, isn't it a matter of common sense? Well, it might appear to be so, but we never know in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's cheshbonos the value of a life. So this is the controversy. So the controversy basically is, does halacha recognize, well, let's put it in a positive way. Is a person dead when their brain is destroyed? All of the brain. Or is a person dead only when the heart stops beating? Now, the problem is the following. You do have, from the Chumash itself, if you just looked at the Chumash itself, you could have two contradictory inferences. One inference is that when the Torah describes the creation of Adam, the Torah describes Hashem as breathing. Vayipach biapav nishmat chayim. Hashem breathed into Adam the neshama of life. And indeed, to this very day, when the Chevra Kedisha, you know, determines somebody's dead, they put a feather by the nose to see if the feather moves, if there's Lenin Neshima. Now that would indicate that Chiyus, life, is defined by the Koach HaNeshima. If that's true, since a brain-dead person does not have a Koach of spontaneous respiration, because it's just mechanical pumping of air, that would indicate he's dead, and indeed that was the Rabbanut's position in 1980s. But of course that raises some problems, because if you're going to tell me it's the Kayach HaNeshima that defined you as alive, what about people on the old iron lungs or whatever it would be? They also, I mean, they were even conscious and able to communicate and the like. Would they be called dead? Well, certainly not, but at least when there's brain stem death, and they, by the way, the brain stem death tests even reflexes. They shine a light in the eye, and the pupil does not dilate. They would jab a needle in the arm, it would not respond, meaning the body is pretty dead, but the blood is still circulating, keeping the organs fresh. In the organ donor community, this may sound a little macabre, a little negative, they say that the perfect organ donor is a healthy teenager who rides a motorcycle without a helmet. Because what you want, I shouldn't say what you want, the ideal transplant donor is a physically healthy body with a smashed brain. So he's brain dead, but you can put him on a respirator and you have healthy organs that can be harvested. In fact, maybe it's a joke, it probably is a joke, but there was something circulating on the internet that when different state legislatures were proposing mandatory helmet laws for people riding motorcycles, some say the organ donation lobby was opposed to it because they thought it would cut down. It probably was a bad joke, but something like that. Okay, now, so one raya from the Chumash is Kolach HaNeshima defines you as alive, and that would indicate when there's brainstem death, the person is dead. On the other hand, we have other psukim. When the Torah says, do not eat blood, so the Torah says, ki adam hu hanefesh. The dam is the nefesh. The life of a person is in the blood, which might indicate that when blood is being circulated, that person is considered to be alive. Big, big machlokas. Now, I can't go over everything here. The RCA, Rabbinical Council of America, which is a large organization of Orthodox rabbis in the United States. They also have a branch of rabbis in Israel as well. They have a Vat Halacha, and the RCA was for many years guided by Rabbi Moshe Tendler, who is an extreme proponent that Halacha accepts brain death. This is his position absolutely, and he encourages organ donation. And the RCA went along with that, but just 2 years ago they issued a big, big report in which they said that it's a much more difficult shaila. Rabbi Tendler was furious, but this is it. But as they say, the RCA really is not a body that can decide these halachas. The RCA has, you know, Baruch Hashem, esteemed rabbis. I myself am a member of the RCA. But once again, in Psak Halacha, we don't have a Sanhedrin here. So the fact that a majority of the RCA votes a certain way is not Machriya Halacha Lamaisa. We have to look at Gedolei Halacha. So I have to say this. A majority of contemporary poskim have not accepted brain death as an acceptable criterion of death, but it's not for a uniform reason. It's important to understand that the poskim that have rejected brain death have not done so for the same reason. Some poskim have rejected brain death because they have said, as long as the heart is beating, the person is alive, and removal of the organ is murder. That's one school. Another school, the Shlomo Zalman Orbach, is willing to concede that in principle, total destruction of the brain would be proof of death, but Rav Shlomo Zalman was very skeptical that the tests were conclusive. And indeed, there's some scientific support for that, because number one, brain dead patients do have body temperature, and body temperature is controlled by the hypothalamus, and that indicates some of the brain is functioning. Brain deaf women who are pregnant have been able to continue pregnancies and bring babies to term. Now, the point to see here is, this is a totally different principle. Rav Orbach is not disputing brain death as an acceptable criterion. He is disputing whether the diagnosis of brain death truly establishes destruction of the brain. A third group of poskim basically says that we are in doubt whether life is based on brain or lave. And if we are in doubt, so even though, you know, one way or the other, somebody's going to die, but shevi al tasin, when you're in doubt, you cannot do an affirmative action. So there are really three different views of those who reject brain death. Now, with respect to Rav Moshe Feinstein's position, now Rav Moshe Feinstein was nifter quite a while ago, in 86, and sorry, my son was named Moshe after Rav Moshe Feinstein was born in 87, and Rav Moshe does have a number of tshuvos on heart transplants, and the question is, those tshuvos are very, very difficult to clearly decipher, because in part because the science of brain death was not as well understood then. Rabbi Tendler, who was Rav Moshe Feinstein's son-in-law, has argued in numerous forums that Rav Moshe Feinstein certainly endorsed the concept of brain death, and he would validate organ transplantation. Other poskim that have looked at the tshuvas, and including Rav David Feinstein, Rav Moshe's son, have said it's equivocal. I can't go over the textual, maybe I'll devote another session to it. The texts are indeed a bit obscure. But here's the one point. So Rav Moshe, I would have to say, is still an unknown on this, but Rav Elyashiv, Rav Waldenberg, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, for different reasons, Rav Dayan Weiss, the Minchas Yitzchak, they all do not accept brain death. But Rav Ovadia, this is interesting, Rav Ovadia, Besof Yamav, actually concluded that Halacha does accept brain death as an acceptable criterion of death, and as a result, he actually would allow organ donation as a great mitzvah of pikuach nefesh, because halacha recognizes death, brain death as acceptable death. Yeah.
Yo, first of all, Robert Weiss,
yes,
told me,
yep,
that he speaking to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein,
yes,
believed that Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was against brain,
yes,
death.
Yes.
He's the main proponent, I think.
That's correct.
The other that, side, and he's the one for the good.
That's correct. In the United States, yeah, yeah. Well, Reich will of course say that. I just want to say, in America, the two big poskim that fight it out are Rabbi J. David Reich, who's really a phenomenal Talmud Chacham, who has written many, many books and articles how halacha absolutely rejects brain death. And then we have Rav Moshe Tendler, who's also a big Talmud Chacham, who asserts over and over and over again in numerous international places that halacha requires the acceptance of brain death, and they both use Rav Moshe. And but as I say, Rav Bleich has tended to be supported by other gedolim. Yeah.
Also,
yeah.
No, I just want to say that we have a friend who's one of the top radiologists in the country.
Yeah.
And he holds with Rav Orma.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And he reads tests all the time. He believes that they are not very good.
Yes,
yet,
yes, yes.
And he believes that it is very difficult to establish.
Yeah,
that's
right, and this is very important. It's important to understand that Rabbi Tendler actually does have a major conceptual victory here, because in truth, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach absolutely accepted brain death as a halachic definition of death. His isser of transplantation was not because he rejected the concept, but because he considered the test not to be definitive, and indeed many, many neurologists have come to that conclusion as well. Yeah.
I just want to tell each and every one of you that I have a younger sister who in 1998 had a heart transplant at Brigham and William Medical Center in Boston.
Yeah.
She is the most active person. It's a miracle.
How many years was that?
1998.
Beautiful, beautiful.
And
kind of her. Yeah.
And then her kidneys failed last year. Mm-hmm. She went in for a kidney replacement. Somebody donated that. Baruch Hashem.
Baruch Hashem, that's wonderful.
She's driving, she's teaching.
That's wonderful. Now let me just end with one thing which is very relevant to you, and it's relevant to people to know. And that is, okay, let's say we adopt the halachic position of most poskim, that the removal of an organ based on brain death is forbidden. Let's assume you go to Chumrah. Am I allowed to be a recipient of the organ? Now, Rabbi Tendler has argued, you can't have it both ways. Rabbi Tendler has said, if you don't accept brain death, you are not allowed to put yourself on an organ recipient list. And yet we know, as a matter of fact, many, many Haredi Jews who are machmir, very machmir, that they would never allow donation of their organ, are willing to take organs. So it's important to understand the following. This may sound, again, a little uncomfortable ethically, but halakhically the reasoning is the following. The poskim have said, even if you consider brain death to be a forbidden, or organ removal from a brain dead person to be a forbidden intervention, you are permitted to benefit from it after the fact, and they make the following argument. In organ donation, the demand for the organ is always greater than the supply. So I'll make up a number. For every heart that's available for transplantation, there might be 10 people who could use it. And that's even after genetic screening. So consequently, if I say I'm not going to take the organ because I believe removal of the organ is murder, the donor is going to be murdered anyway. The donor is going to be halachically killed one way or the other. So halacha says, if you're not the cause, now if you're the only person, without you they're not going to take it, then ein achinami, you would not be allowed to put yourself on the list. But if they're going to take it out of his heart, out of his body, with you or without you, you are permitted to benefit. In other words, we don't have what's called an exclusionary rule that you have in legal systems. We don't say, since it came through an immoral process, you can't benefit. So that's an important point, and you know that would validate the idea that a religious Jew is allowed to receive organs if the organ is gonna be removed, bein kach u bein kach.